It's lucky for you because today we look at Bell's theorem. And Bell's theorem is, I would say, one of the most profound discoveries of the 20th century. If you're a realist, if you want to be a realist, then Bell's theorem captures a deep tension between quantum theory and relativity theory, a tension that I would argue hasn't been resolved adequately if you're a realist. So it's sort of a long-standing mystery. It's still with us today. And my approach is going to be, rather than give you the technical developments first, I'm going to try to make Bell's theorem as intuitively clear as possible first. Because I think you should really feel it in your bones, rather than say, I did a calculation and it proved a result. I want you to really understand what the significance is. So I'm going to try very hard to make it as trivial as possible. So if you feel at the end of this, wow, that's just trivial, that's good, because it means you've understood it and it's a really important result, so you should understand it in a very deep way. So I hope that you're not put off by the fact that if at the end it turns out to be a simple result. So I'm going to say one thing before getting started. It doesn't really matter what interpretational persuasion you have for quantum theory. Bell's theorem is extremely significant. But just to put in the context of what we've been discussing this week, if you take a bunch of quantum phenomena that you find perhaps surprising from a classical perspective, and then ask the following question, which of them can you capture qualitatively in the sort of theory we've been describing in the last couple of days, a restricted statistical classical theory? And what I tried to argue is that there's a bunch of them, like teleportation, no cloning, collapse, the existence of entanglement and non-commutativity, and others, which we didn't talk about, which can all be captured in this sort of approach. And so there is a way of saying that these things aren't such a big departure from classical theories. Maybe they're a departure in the sense that we have a fundamental restriction on what we can know, and that's mysterious, but they're not a departure in the sense that we need to change our fundamental notion of what is real. You have a question?
What's metrology?
Metrology is things like clock synchronization and aligning gyroscopes and things, and precision measurements. So quantum theory offers improvements for those sorts of tasks. And you can basically explain them with squeezing. And we saw that squeezing existed in this restricted Liouville theory that we talked about. So it falls over here. But nonetheless, there's some stuff that remains. And Bell's theorem is at the top of the list. There's also contextuality, which we'll start talking about tomorrow. The quantum computational speedup, if it exists, there's no proof that there's that quantum computation is in a different complexity class from classical computation, although everybody believes it's the case. And then there are others as well that follow on the right-hand side. So from the perspective of the psi epistemic approaches we've been talking about, one should really focus on the things that are in the right-hand column because they're what pose the a challenge to the research program. They're the obstacle to trying to complete that research program. So I like to think about this as there's sort of two kinds of non-classicality. There's type one, which you can explain by assuming there's a restriction, how much you can know. And then there's type two, which you can't explain within a realist framework in that sort of way. So see, the next few lectures are going to be about that frontier. Right? What are the obstacles to these kinds of approaches to hidden variables? OK, so here's the setup for understanding Bell's theorem. You have a pair of two outcome measurements. So it doesn't matter what they are, but they're distinct measurements. I'll call them S and T. And they each have two outcomes. So I'm just going to imagine that they have two LED lights on them. And one outcome is the green LED light turning on, and the other outcome is the red LED light turning on. That's it. And what you do is you prepare a pair of systems, and you send one system to each of these apparatuses. And these apparatuses are set up far apart from one another. And eventually, we'll be talking about the fact that these are prepared in a quantum state. But forget about that for now. Just what happens in the lab, we prepare two systems, and we separate them. good. And now there's going to be one of four types of measurements done. there's going to be either the same measurement, S and S, done on both wings, or it's going to be S on the left and T on the right, or it's going to be T on the left and S on the right, or T on both wings. And then there's going to be certain correlations that you observe between those measurements. So to understand the correlations, we have to ask, is it possible for these two systems to be prepared to basically have a kind of local instruction set of what to do if they get each of the possible measurements? So each of these measurements is going to be happening with probability a half when they get to the respective ends, and the particles are going to have to give an answer for each possible measurement. So you want to know, is there some way that they could choreograph their answers so that they generate the kinds of correlations we see? So anyways, to make that totally clear what the problem is, I want to do a demonstration of the Bell inequality. So I need Tibra to help. you know the drill. And I need two volunteers to generate correlations. I have one volunteer, two volunteers. OK, stand up. And Tibra, given that we have so little room at the front, why don't, Tibra, you go to the back, and I'll give you your equipment. Right, hang on. Okay. I'll repeat again from last year what was going on here. There you go. And why don't you come with me? You're up here. So we're the, you know, actually you have to go with Tibra. So Tibra is basically playing the role of the measurement device on the right. I'm playing the role of the measurement device on the left. And you guys are going to be the particles who are generating the correlations. So you're going to be able to, at the beginning, actually, why don't you start in the middle? You know, you're still in that device together. And you're going to be able to come up with a strategy. Once I tell you what the correlations you're trying to generate are, you're going to get to confer on a strategy for how to generate those correlations. And to sweeten the pot, you each get a dollar if you get it right. Okay. Just because, you know, otherwise, why would you do this? So here's the challenge. As I said, there's two possible measurements that you each might be facing. And the way we're going to do that is that Tibra and I are each going to flip a coin. And if it's head, we're going to write S down on this piece of paper and hand it to you. And that means you're facing the S measurement. And if it's tails, we're going to write T down and hand it to you. That means you're facing the tails measurement. And then you get to respond with green or red as the outcome that you are generating in the device. Okay. And now here's the deal, that if it happens that the same measurement is made on both wings, then your outcomes should agree. So you don't know ahead of time what the result of the coin flip is. So you don't know if you're going to be facing the situation where you both have S. But you better have plans such that if you're both getting the S measurement, then your outcomes, whether they're green or red, they should agree. Similarly, if you both get the T measurement, your outcomes should agree. But if you get different measurements, then your outcomes should disagree. And if you can satisfy those correlations, you win.
Yes? Well, just to be clear, do they know whether they're facing the same measurement?
They don't, because the choice of measurement on each wing is going to be set by a random coin flip.
Okay, once they come to us, you know, they can't really communicate with
them. That's right. And we're going to imagine that we're simulating space-like separation. We're going to be keeping an eye on you to make sure that there's no signs passed between you about what measurement you're receiving. So once you get here, you get to look at the piece of paper and write your answer, but you can't communicate to your partner what your measurement is. So are the rules clear?
Yeah.
Clear? All right, so take some time to think about your strategy. Meanwhile, everybody else should figure out what strategy could be used. You can confer among yourselves. What strategy can you adopt that will win this game?
What does it mean the same measurement is made? They see the same
result or the same measurement procedure is performed?
Yeah, what I mean is that at the two wings, it so happens that the coin flips come up the same, such that they're both being asked the same question. Right, so there's this four ways that the coins could come up. They could come up so that we're both asking S, I ask S, he asks T, he asks S, I ask T, or we both ask T. They
so
need to be prepared.
One side of the coin.
Yep.
One side of the coin.
If it comes up heads, I'm going
to
ask
S.
And if it comes up tails, I'm going to ask T. So these are just two measurement devices. So it's as if I'm choosing to do one of two different measurements.
In response to either S or T, they're going to either show a red or a green light.
That's right.
So
exactly.
If they see S, they're going to say
green, say.
Or red. They have to be consistent in doing.
Well, they have to satisfy these correlations, right? So they can choose any strategy they want, but if they want to win, then it better be that when I bring the two cards together at the end, we're going to write down the results. We're going to say on the left it was S, and on the right it was T. Let's say that's how it came up. And then we're going to say, okay, it was answered red on the left, and it was answered green on the T. And the rule says that if they have different measurements, their outcome should disagree. So then they would win. But if they both answered red, when one got S, the other got T, they lose.
But if both are S's, and they both say green, then they win.
Right.
Now it's just cool, like if they get two S's in a row, do they have to say the same color over time, or do they have to be consistent in that sense, or can they just pick them?
Yeah, we're just going to do this once. I mean, you're right, they could get lucky and win. They might have a strategy that's not a consistently winning strategy, but I'm going to allow them to use any strategy they want in every run of the experiment, and we'll just see if they manage. And then afterwards, we'll ask them what the strategy was, and then figure out. We're setting up a GMC. Are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So go to your respective measuring stations. Okay, so now as close to simultaneous as possible and quietly. So let me write this down for them. Okay. Are you done over there? An answer was provided?
No.
Not yet? Okay. This is what we call the delayed choice experiment.
My rule as we worked that out was not capable of answering this one.
Well, try your best. You have to provide an answer.
Yeah, I do, didn't I? How did she answer first?
Well, it's irrelevant whether you answer first or she thinks you're not communicating with each other.
What's the T and S? Sorry, what? So H is
T is tails and S is heads.
Yeah.
S is H and T is.
Why is S heads and T is tails? Okay. I'm the worst, like, particle ever. I just have to remember one thing. I got the result.
I can remember.
Okay.
So you need to say either red or green.
Okay, so I'm pretty sure this is green.
So write it down. Yeah. It's just one bit of information. Yeah. Okay, great. So, this is the moment of truth. Okay, so on the left, that was S. T was asked, and on the right, S was asked. And the answer here was green, and the answer here was red, and so you win. So you collect your prize, yes. And The question is, what was your strategy?
Chain with red, and that's
the
three,
and
that was it.
Okay, so.
So I got H, I was like, wait, I think I should definitely remember it was SS3. And that's right. I was like,
okay, so that's. This is. You can sit down, thank you very much. Yeah. Round of applause for the particles. okay, so this is the game. You know, there's two possibilities over here on the left, two possibilities on the right. If they're the same, the outcomes should agree. If they're different, the outcomes should disagree. So one strategy that works is that if you're given, if each of them says, look, if we face S, we'll answer green. If we face T, we'll answer red. We'll both do that. And by doing that, you get agreement here, and disagreement across these two. So you always win. Okay. And you used that exact same thing. You could have also changed the colors. It wouldn't have made a difference. Okay, next challenge. So this, we're not going to act this one out. let me ask you how to solve this one. So again, there's two possible measurements on each side, two possible outcomes. But now, whenever the same measurement is made, then the outcome should disagree, whereas when different choices of measurement are made, the outcomes should agree. Sorry?
You want to correlate them.
No, you want to correlate.
That's right. You have anti-correlated outcomes when the measurement choices are the same, and correlated outcomes when the choice of measurement is different.
Yeah, but instead of both of them being green,
that's right. So you're saying that the strategy should be that they do the opposite of what the other person does. Exactly. Right. So if it's green for S and red for T on the left, and is red for S and green for T on the right, then they'll be disagreeing across the top and the bottom, and they'll be agreeing across the diagonals. Okay. Simple enough. So you get the idea of how two particles that have some correlations that are an agreement about what they're going to do in different scenarios can generate different kinds of correlations. So here's the third one. So there's a dollar in this for whoever can answer this one. Again, two measurements, two outcomes. But now, whenever the measurement T is made on both sides, the outcomes should disagree. But in all the other cases, S and S, S and T, or T and S, the outcomes should agree. So take a few minutes and think it over.
Can we put on both lights at the same time?
No. No, it's one or the other. Wait, don't tell me the answer yet. Just think it over. You can get together in groups if you want, figure it out. But in a minute or so, I'll ask for potential solutions. No, one of the lights has to flash.
Can you flash the same light twice?
I guess you could do whatever you want, but it means you'll lose, right? Because you won't have satisfied these conditions. So if no light turns on, I consider that a failure to ensure these correlations, and therefore a loss. It's the same setup as we just saw. The particles are like the two contestants. They have to come up with a strategy, and later they're not going to find out what the other person's being asked. They just have to be ready with an answer for every possible measurement that's presented to them. Well, let me just ask this. Does anybody think they've got a solution, a way to win the game? You think you have a way to win? All right, let's hear it.
If one person always says green, and the other person, does their outcome depend on, what they get?
Okay.
So if one person says green, whether they get T or S, and the other person says green when they get T and red when they get S, or the other way around, I don't
know. Okay, so green when they get T, red when they get S. This is the
protocol. It doesn't work.
Good, you took the bait, thank you. it's useful to write it out like this and see. But so the problem in this case is that they were supposed to disagree if they both had T, and they don't disagree, they agree. So you're supposed to have agreement here.
Maybe you can meet it the other way around.
Yeah, sorry. So let me, you're probably thinking of this strategy here, green. So then you have agreement here, disagreement here, so let me write that as a dashed line. All those are good, but then you have disagreement here, and you're supposed to have agreement. Other takers for solution? There's a dollar to be won. This should, make you bold. When's the last time you had a chance to win a dollar? Yes?
Cannot be done.
Good. Well, why? Or convince me, I should say.
Okay, well, I mean, if you just go through all the possibilities, none of them satisfy. I mean, if you choose, use a strategy depending on given T you have a certain color and given S you have a certain color, then no matter how you choose it, none of these strategies will satisfy that. So you need something else, but since communication isn't allowed.
Okay, can you... besides an exhaustive proof, where we would write down, there's two options for each.
You can do
you can
S.
On the board now. Yeah.
Sorry?
If I assign one color to each, then S.
Oh, hang on. I'm going to ask over here first, because there's a dollar at stake. I don't want to have to split that. So maybe, I'm just wondering if, rather than an exhaustive proof, can you see a kind of a way of arguing for it without going through all the possibilities?
Okay, well, there's no way you're going to get three to agree if you only have two colors, because and one to disagree, because if you say T is green, then there will always be two possibilities that will agree with it.
Saying that on the other side you'll have to have two agreements, is that what you're saying?
You always have two that have the same that will agree.
Right, okay. These two here.
So the T is green, S is green in that case, but S is green and S is also green in that case. But no matter how you choose the colors, how you assign the colors to the laters, you're always going to have two cases where they agree and two where they disagree.
So you say no matter how you assign the colors, there'll always be two agreements and two disagreements.
Yes.
But I could assign the same color to everything. You know, both parties could say we're going to answer green in any case.
Okay, but then there will never be a disagreement, so that's really okay.
Okay, good. Yes. This is your prize. Well done. Let me give one other version of this proof. So you're absolutely right. You could just do an exhaustive case of all 16 possibilities, you know, green or red here, et cetera, and see that none of them satisfy that. But you can also think about it like in the following way. Suppose you chose to answer green for T on the right. Then, by virtue of the diagonal that the outcomes have to agree, you'd have to answer green for S on the left. And by virtue of the top line, the outcomes agreeing, you have to answer green for S on the right. And then by virtue of this other diagonal, you have to answer green here. And then you don't have the outcomes disagreeing. If I'd chosen red, then I would have the same setup, and I wouldn't have had the outcomes agree. And I could have started anywhere and followed the sequence of implications and derived a contradiction. So that's another way of saying that there's no way of satisfying it. So what's the best probability of winning this game? So let's say we did it many times, all right? So let's say we were doing it today with two people who are setting up a strategy, and we were repeating it many, many times. On average, how often could they win? 75%? Yeah, because you can always get a strategy like the all green one, which wins 3/4 of the time, and every other choice will at most win 3/4 of the time. There are choices that win a smaller amount of the time, but they can always win 3/4 of the time, and they can't do any better. And so now here's the puzzling fact, which is that in quantum theory, there's a way of winning this game 85% of the time. Approximately 85% of the time. So the question is, if we were doing this here today, and you know we set it up, and I gave them this problem, and we found that they were winning more than 75% of the time, what would we conclude? Yes?
How do we win 85% of the time?
How do we win 85% of the time? I'll show you that in about two slides, or maybe more than two. But yeah, we'll get to that calculation. I'll convince you of that. But for the moment, I want to say, if we saw it today, you know, and you know, maybe they've got quantum particles in their pockets, but you know, we saw them win. You know, what would be our natural inclination? That they were communicating, but what information would they communicate to one another? What you were asked, right? So if the answer is if that there was communication from one wing to the other of what the choice of the measurement was, then you could do this. So let me go back and sort of take us through that. So let's say, let's fill it in. Okay, so let's say over here on the left, communicated to the person on the right whether they were asked S or T. Then the person on the right could say, right, if they were asked S, then I'll answer green. But if I find out they were asked T, then I'll answer red. And then you can satisfy disagreement here and agreement here because the outcome is now dependent on what happened here. So they could then get around this and always win the game. Okay, but there's a problem with this. So if we saw it today, then we would say, okay, well, we don't know exactly how they're communicating, but clearly they must be communicating with one another. But suppose we did it in such a way that the two wings of the experiment are very far apart in space, and the choice of the measurement, so when they find out what's being measured and when they have to report their outcome, is a very short period of time, very much unlike the game we saw today, a very short period of time such that even if the person on the left sent out a message at the speed of light revealing what measurement they had over here, it still wouldn't reach the right-hand side before the right-hand side had a chance to report the outcome. So if you saw them continue to win even in that scenario, what would you say? They're bribing the measurer, okay. So you say the measurement is not random after all. There's some collusion. Good. It's a puzzle. If you've chosen these measurements truly at random, it's hard to imagine what's going on. So here's a slightly more mathematical treatment of the problem. Let me just sort of restate it mathematically. What you have is a game where success corresponds to having agreement between the outcomes if they're SS, ST, or TS, and disagreement between the outcomes if the measurements are T and T. And you weight those with the probabilities for each of those things happening. And we're assuming that those probabilities are all equal, a quarter. Each of these four measurements is equally likely. And the point is that if I have a local theory, then we show that that probability of success is less than or equal to 0.75, and that's what's called the Bell inequality. But quantum theory predicts this probability of success, 0.85, and if you go to the lab and you choose your experiments appropriately, you can actually corroborate this prediction of quantum theory, which seems to cause a problem for notions of locality. So here's the slide that explains how to do this in quantum theory. Okay, so we had to have two choices of measurement on each side. What we're going to do is the pair of particles are going to be qubits, two-level systems. They're going to be prepared in an entangled state. And the one on the left is going to be measured either in the Z-spin or the X-spin basis. And the up outcome is going to correspond to green, and the down outcome is going to correspond to red. And the other possibility is to be measured along this spin axis Z plus X, so this one here, or this spin axis X minus Z. And again, up will be green in both cases. Right. Oh, sorry. I thought I had a... No, I guess not. I thought I had the calculation done. But I'll take you through it. Let me do it on the board. So the original state I'm going to take to be 1 over root 2, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. And we know that if on the left you measure some spin along some axis that's in the xz plane, then that corresponds to a block vector up along some axis n, which I can write out as cos theta. So the 0 now is just the z spin up state. Sine theta 1. I can act this on this state, and what I do is I collapse the system on the right-hand side to being the same superposition of 0 and 1. Sine theta 1. So I collapse it on the right-hand side to be up along the n-axis as well. Right, so this is similar to what you've done in I think it was the homework, where you find out how to update the state of the distant system when you learn something about the state of this system. So if I find this guy up along Z, then I update my description of the faraway guy to up along Z. If I find him down, I update this guy to down. Similarly for measurements along the X-spin axis. So what it means is that if over here you get, say, the T green outcome up along Z, then you collapse that distant system to the point on the block sphere up here. And then if you do a measurement of S, then you get the green outcome with probability equal to the cosine of this angle over 2 all squared. That's just the regular formula in the block sphere for calculating the probability of an outcome given a preparation. And I get the down outcome with 1 minus that probability. So if this angle between the north and this is pi by 4 on the block sphere. And the formula for calculating the probability of getting this outcome given the state is cos squared theta over 2. So it's pi by 4 over 2. So it's cos squared pi over 8. And that you can work out is approximately 0.85. So that's one example. But let's go through all of them. So suppose S was measured on the left and S was measured on the right. So in that case, their outcomes are supposed to agree. So if I get the green outcome here, then I collapse this guy to this state, and the overlap with the S green outcome is, again, 85%. If I get the red outcome, I collapse to this state, and the overlap with the red outcome is 85%. If I measure S here and T over there, so say I get the green outcome, I collapse to this guy. Well, T green is only pi by 4 away, so the probability is 85% of agreement. Similarly, if I get S red, then T red is 85% likely. And T and S is the same. T green is close to S green, so there's your 85%. And finally, for T and T, it's the one case where the green outcomes are on opposite sides of the block sphere, roughly. So if I get T green here, and I collapse to this state, and I measure T, I'm now more likely to get the red outcome. And the probability of getting the red outcome is 85%. So in all four of these cases, the probability of seeing the correlation that's required is 85%. Is that clear? So I apologize for not having the math. I had a computer problem this morning, and I thought it was there, but it's gone. That's in the slides. OK, thanks. Good. So that's just the explanation of what quantum theory predicts. The next fact that's relevant here is that you can't use these kinds of correlation to signal information, to communicate from one wing to the other. And that's really the puzzle of Bell's theorem, that on the one hand, it seems like there is information that has to propagate from one wing to the other to tell the particle what to do, to tell it what the measurement was over here on the left. And yet, if there is such superluminal causation, it can't be used to signal. So what's the argument of no signaling? So imagine you have an arbitrary state of two systems in the middle, rho AB. And then you measure this POVM on the left and this POVM on the right. So if you then ask, well, what do the statistics over here look like? The probability distribution of outcomes J. And do they depend on the choice of POVM? So if I go from measuring spin along the z-axis to spin along the x-axis over here, does that affect the probabilities? Because if it does, then you could use that to signal, right? You could set these guys very far apart with a whole bunch of entangled particles, right? So many pairs. And then this person would, you know, on the first one, measure z if they want to communicate 0, say, and x if they want to communicate 1. And over on the other end, the guy would do measurements. And if his statistics had some information about whether it was z or x, then he would get some information about what Alice over here is trying to encode. So if we work out the quantum expression, the probability of J is just the sum over K, the probability of getting K here and J there. That's just this formula here, which should be familiar. But if I sum over K and I bring that sum inside, then sum over K EK, well, this is a POVM, so the sum of its elements is identity. So I just get this expression. And that's true no matter what choice of POVM I put here. If these are projectors onto Z spin eigenstates or projectors onto X spin eigenstates, their sum is still going to be identity. So the overall expression is completely independent of the choice of that POVM on A. And therefore, the statistics on the right don't depend on the choice that Alice has made over here. So they can't use this setup to signal at all. Good. So that's the punchline, that we don't have signaling, and yet we seem to require this superluminal causation to try to explain the strength of the correlations we see. So maybe let me pause there and take questions. Yes?
For the 35%, 85%, I mean, are they a little bit different, though? Because in the first case, you'll be absolutely correct three-quarters of the time and absolutely wrong a quarter of the time. Whereas in the quantum case, you're always 85% sure. You know, so like, it seems like you've got more information, but you don't, right? Because you're not sure about which measurements are correct which aren't. Whereas in the classical case, you sort of were. Is that just because...
Well, we can imagine the following strategy. Suppose in the Bell challenge, you said, okay, let's answer, you know, always green some of the time, in which case, you know, we'll fail when we both get asked T, where our outcomes are supposed to disagree. But some of the time, we'll answer some different pattern, which means that we succeed when the questions are T and T, but we fail when the questions are S and S. So you could have a probabilistic mixture of strategies, right? So you agree ahead of time, you know, you flip a coin, you say, okay, this time we're going to use strategy one, and that's going to get the TT outcome right. And so if I repeated this a whole bunch of time, I wouldn't find you always getting T and T wrong. I might find you, you know, what you get wrong changes. And that would be just like what you see in quantum mechanics, where 85% of the time you get the correlation that you expect, and 15% of the time it fails. It's just that in the classical strategy, it would be 25% of the time that you're failing to get it right. Yes?
So I guess in some sense, quantum theory has more correlation than classical theory, but not enough to validate special relativity, or not enough to basically signage.
That's right. So what's surprising about Bell's result is, you know, you might have thought that the only notion of locality that was meaningful was a kind of signaling notion, but it's clear that there's certain kinds of correlation which you can't explain by imagining that, you know, particles have properties and they can't communicate to one another, even at a sort of hidden level. If you imagine that there's no causation that can propagate superluminally, then you have a hard time explaining how how you could get such strong correlations between the two wings of the experiment. Yes?
Well, is the data pretty stupid comment, but and Schrödinger was deriving his equation, right?
Yeah.
He was thinking of relativity in a way. Like,
yes.
Special relativity. So in a way, you could say that the causality structure of special relativity could be hidden in the postulates of quantum mechanics somehow in a very abstruse way.
Yeah, to some extent, we've built them in here by saying, for instance, that the way we ought to represent a measurement on the left is as some operator on one Hilbert space tests their identity on the other Hilbert space. And the way we represent the measurement on the right is identity tensor that operator. And so by construction, we've asked that these two operators, which correspond to space-like separated measurements, commute. And that's ultimately the reason that we could do this calculation and find no dependence of the statistics here on the choice of measurement over here. So that's the sense in which we've, by hand, ensured that there can be no signaling in quantum theory by a choice of how to represent these measurements. But what's surprising is that, you know, despite that absence of signaling, how do we explain the strength of the correlations in a way that doesn't require superluminal causation? Yes.
Yeah, given the theory where there's no signaling, but we can still, like, we can see Bell's inequality by more, so the correlation would be less than 85%.
Yeah. There's no reason why you couldn't go up to, you know, probability one. So you could have more Bell inequality violation than quantum theory allows. And one of the really interesting questions that people are asking today in foundations. Sort of it's a trend in axiomatization. People try to come up with axioms that rule out theories that have more non-locality than quantum mechanics. In the past, people have spent a lot of time thinking about what kinds of axioms might get us over 75%. But you can also ask the question, what gets us down to 85% from where we could have been? So that's an active subject of research. All right, let me move on. Here's a question for you. Suppose the particles had access to local randomness, so they didn't give a deterministic answer. Would that help them generate these correlations? Why not? I mean, yes, in the case where they're supposed to, let me draw it out. It's so the Bell challenge is we want disagreement between the cases where it's T and T, and we want agreement in the other three cases. This should be agree and agree.
Well, then you're going to have half the time it's going to be red, half the time it's going to be green. So then I think you reduce your percentage of success to 50%.
Yeah, if you made it truly random, you reduce it to 50%. But if you do any kind of deviation from, you know, a deterministic strategy, you're only going to get weaker correlations, not stronger correlations, because your problem is choreographing what's done over here with what's going on over there. And adding some local randomness is just going to make it less correlated. So the answer to Bell's theorem is not there is fundamental indeterminism in nature, because it doesn't help you explain the strength of these correlations. Yes?
If you completely randomized one of the T measurements for one of the people, wouldn't you end up with like a 50% probability of agreement for S and T and 50% disagreement for T and T? So you wouldn't actually decrease anything? You'd stay the same.
Oh, I see. So you're saying there might be strategies wherein you don't do worse. So, well, if that may be, let me think. So you're saying suppose these guys are answering what?
S and T are fine, and S is the same, but then one of the T's just so
these are both green,
random.
Say?
Leave three and make one T completely random.
Okay, and then make this one half of the time red and half of the time green. And this guy up here is going to be green? Yeah, okay. So then we have agreement here, and then 50% of the time we'll have agreement here, and 50% of the time we'll have disagreement here, so that'll give 75. So yeah, that's right. And so I guess I misspoke. It's not that it always gives you less correlation, but it can't give you more correlation in the end. Thanks. Yes?
How's the experimental status of that bound?
Well, the experimental status is that since the 80s, people have been testing this sort of thing, and we've corroborated a violation of Bell inequality to very close to 85%. Experimental inefficiencies mean we don't quite get up to 85% with very high statistical confidence. So, you can go 30 sigma, 1,000 sigma away from the bound. So the chance that the probability that it's just a fluke is vanishingly small. But in a moment I'll talk about some experimental constraints. So this first question, no, randomness won't help you. Determinism is not an assumption of Bell's theorem. Second question, is the proof robust to experimental imperfections? So suppose the detector sometimes just fails to register any outcome at all. Okay, so you set it up, you send the two particles off, and this detector just doesn't respond. Can you still show that something funny is going on? Can you still challenge locality if your experiment, if your devices are not 100%
experimental? Just reduce the accuracy.
The accuracy of what? The accuracy of? Right. Exactly, right. So you could run the experiment many times, and rather than getting the quantum prediction of 85% of the time fulfilling the correlations, it's only 80% of the time, because some of the time you have a failure. So you count all those failed detections as not winning, but you could still be higher than 75%, and so you could still violate the Bell inequality even though your detectors aren't perfect. Next question, if the detector inefficiencies are sufficiently high, could you take just the cases where you did find a detection and for those cases alone look at the probability of winning the game and see that you're doing better than 75%? So what I'm saying is, if the people who are running the game show say, well, we're not going to count those runs where no answer was provided, then in the runs where answers are provided, could the contestants win the game more than 75% of the time? Why not? Sorry, say it again?
Because the detectors just not giving you an outcome. then that wouldn't affect the time that it does give you an outcome. You still have a 75% probability.
And what about in the game show scenario? So suppose you were told, look, when you get to the respective wings and you're presented with the question, you have the choice of providing an answer, or some of the time you can just say, I choose not to play, and then, you know, we start over. Would that help you win the game in the cases where you do choose to play?
Only if you came up with, like, an agreement that you would choose not to play whenever you got, say, S or whatever. Because the only time that your strategy failed is when you had, you know, the S and not the green. But then S is like you're doing three answers because you're using the failure as an answer to communicate everything.
Okay. Yes.
So that's just like a systematic failure of the machine, isn't it? Like another one could just be that the machine fails in that it always gives like the right correlations. Like, it doesn't get it always just says green or something, you know. So you know the strategy that worked for the S is a green.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in that they both gave out green and it only ever gives out green, like the machines just don't do their job. So you can't get the
Like, it's not able to test the case of T and T. Not
quite following you. Like, if your machines are broken,
yeah.
And, like, they... Like, you can't with this strategy of, say, like, the strategy where it works except for one case where it fails.
Say this is the case where it fails.
Okay.
So let's say they use the all-green strategy.
So if you get T and T, then it fails?
Well, you tell me. You're setting up the example. So
you can set it up like that, right? So you can just make it so that your mechanism works every time except for when it gives TNT. But if your code was such that it was going, you're dropping below one, you would have higher than 75% if it weren't for the case being tested. So
I think I see where you're going.
So like the code works for S agreeing with S, like that's going to work.
I hope
it works to give green every time.
Yep.
The machine can only just give green every time. And like, it's like you're not testing it properly, you're just testing always to do correlate.
Okay, I like it. Let me take a few other responses.
Is
what do you think?
Is there a detector inefficiency, like inserting randomness into your system? It doesn't work, unless you know how it doesn't work, and then you are putting more information in. And if you're going to gain any more information from both detectors being inefficient, that means the detectors themselves have to be correlated in some way.
Well, the question I'm asking here, I don't think I've asked it very clearly, so maybe let me try again, which is, suppose it's the particles who get to decide when the detector fails. So rather than imagining that you've got a faulty detector, imagine that you've kind of got a conspiracy going on. You've got particles that are saying, I can make the detector fire, or I could behave in such a way as to cause the detector not to fire. And the question is, can the particles leverage that to help them make an appearance of Bell inequality violations, when in fact, you know, they're just using their local strategy, so they've agreed ahead of time how they're going to answer. And then they leverage this possibility of making the device fail to try to make an appearance of Bell inequality violations. Go ahead. Yes.
Then you can just say that the particle never show S. But then it's easy to see experiment. It will always, you get 100% accuracy in your result that are good, but it's easy to see from experiment that you're not getting any.
Right. So you could do something, so that's also in the right direction. You can do something a little bit more clever with, you know, the particles could kind of randomize their strategy. So say the particles say, you know, they say in a given run, okay, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to, you know, if the particle on the right is going to answer green and green, and the particle on the left is going to answer green for S, and if the particle on the left sees T, the particle is going to fail to generate an outcome. So the TT case was the only case where they were going to lose, and now the particle is failing to generate an outcome. So it's basically preventing them from providing a losing answer. Okay, so if it so happens that T is S on the left, then that run doesn't count. But if some other choice is made, then the particles get the right correlations. And now they can use that strategy, and in every given run, the particular measurement that they choose to fail for is changes. And so if you look at the statistics of all these runs, then you see if they're not consistently failing to generate outcomes on this measurement, you know, sometimes they're failing to generate outcomes here, sometimes they're failing to generate outcomes here, and so on. And so if you thought that there was sort of a fair sampling, if you thought that the reason the detector were firing was just because they're faulty and it wasn't choreographed by the particles, then you might say, well, we can just ignore all those runs where one of the detectors didn't fire. Let's look at how well they did at playing the game in the cases where it did run. And you might say, oh, it's violated Bell inequality. But you would have then ignored a loophole. You know, if you want to be really conservative, you might say, well, we need to worry about, you know, particles influencing whether the detectors fire or not. Because locality is such a cherished notion of physics, we really want to be sure that we can rule it out. So we shouldn't be content with seeing a violation of Bell inequalities for only those runs where the detectors have fired. And so that is called the detector loophole. So you really want to get your detector efficiencies high enough so that they fire most of the time so that you can really violate a Bell inequality even when you take into account the cases where they fired. And so experiments have a difficult time sealing the detector loophole because detector inefficiencies in optics experiments are not that high. Yes?
Explain it again.
Yeah.
It sounded like when you get TNT, then the detectors don't work, right?
Right.
But they're not causally connected, right? Like, they're separated spatially, so how does it?
I don't mean both detectors. I just mean, say, the strategy will be, you know, just this one detector on the left doesn't fire. So the particles have a plan. You know, the right-hand particle is going to always answer green. The left-hand particle is going to answer green if it's asked S and won't fire if it asks T. So then there's two cases where they, you know, if this is the measurement or this is the pair of measurements, then they haven't provided an answer. But if it's one of these two guys, then they have provided an answer, and they're satisfying the correlations of the game. And then they just use a set of strategies wherein they fail to provide an answer for one of the four questions, and the other three answers satisfy these correlations. And in that way, they can always win the game when the detectors fire. Yes?
In experiment, it's quite easy to know which detector. What is its accuracy for example, S and T? And then you can just normalize your result. And if it's not locally, if it's not connected in a non-local way, then you should get the right answer.
Well, the game here, and many people have argued this way, is that we should be very careful about concluding that nature is non-local. And so we should be as pessimistic as possible, as paranoid as possible about how this trick could be done. So although you might say, you know, usually we wouldn't imagine that a detector not firing had anything to do with how, you know, what the state of the particle was. You know, usually we would say it's just a faulty detector. But if you want to be very paranoid, you could say, well, it could be that it fires only when the particle tells it to, and it fails in very particular instances that are correlated with the state of that particle. And if that conspiracy were happening, then we could still explain what was going on with the local theory. So if you really want to rule out local theories and be very, tough-minded about it, you know, you would allow for the possibility of this conspiracy. Let me tell you about the second loophole, and then we'll discuss whether these are reasonable doubts to have or not. So, is there a problem if the choice of measurement is made before the particles are sent to the detectors? So let's say, you set it up, but rather than flipping the, remember I had the setup so that the choices of measurements were such, you know, that if I send light from this measurement, it can't reach the other wing on time before the outcome has to be registered. But suppose the choice of measurement was made much earlier in the past. Would that be a problem?
do you mean by problem?
I mean, could you find a violation of Bell inequality even though the particles are not signaling to one another superluminally? So could there be a local explanation of Bell inequality violations?
Well, then the choice of measurement could affect somehow the particle before it's sent.
Right.
Because the cones now overlap both.
Exactly. If it's far enough in the past, it could influence the state of the pair of particles. And it could also, over here on the right, could obtain information about what sort of measurement was being done on the left because it was set long ago and there was time for light to propagate over here. So strictly speaking, if these choices aren't made at space-like separation, then you could have, by relativity theory, you could imagine that the outcome over on the right depends on the setting on the left. Yes?
How is that different from communication?
It's different. So if the choices are made sort of on the fly at space-like separation, then the information has to get from here to here at a speed that's greater than the speed of light. Whereas if this choice of measurement was made far in the past, then it can get from here to here at a speed less than the speed of light. That's the difference. Yes?
But then the particles would somehow have to read our minds or something, the experimenters. They'd have to be basically, not as particles, but sentient beings to be able to.
So you're saying suppose that the choice of measurement was made by the free will of the experimenter.
Right.
And then it doesn't matter that the experimenter has decided in the past, because you think it's implausible that a particle over there would feel some causal influence from what I've decided to do.
Yeah, or the other device would know what this device had been set to.
Right.
So devices would have to talk to each other.
Right. So you're saying it's implausible.
It's very implausible, yeah.
Okay. Good. So that's true. But nonetheless, it's a loophole.
Right.
So if you want to be very skeptical and you say, you know, I cherish locality, and so I'm looking for every opportunity to save locality and explain experimental outcomes while preserving locality, then you can say, well, maybe something like this is happening, that if you don't make the choices of measurements on the fly, then this implausible mechanism is actually happening. The state of the particle on the right is depending causally at subluminal velocities on what the choice of measurement on the left is. And that's called the locality loophole. So the experimental status, I'll take your questions in a second. The experimental status is that we have an experiment that seals the detector loophole but does not seal the locality loophole. And we have other experiments that seal the locality loophole but don't seal the detector loophole. And no experiment that seals them both. But there's also a question, which is, should we worry about sealing these loopholes? Is this being too, too suspicious? So there were some questions. Yes?
Have you done a test to see if the locality loophole affects the outcome? Like if the detectors are really close together, then you get a higher probability than if they're really far away, apart.
There doesn't seem to be any dependence of the amount of Bell inequality violation on the distance between the wings of the experiment.
Okay.
So they've done a bunch of experiments. I mean, they're even proposing to do experiments between satellites and the surface of the Earth. I think the best experiments now are on the order of tens or hundreds of kilometers, and there doesn't seem to be any drop in the degree of violation. Yes?
But how can we solve the locality loophole? Because if we really, really want to save that, then we say, well, if we say the world is deterministic, then everything is already set. So.
Yep.
There's no problem.
Good point. So, and there are some people who say that, which is, this is sometimes called the superdeterminism solution. So there are people who say, if the world really is deterministic, and furthermore, far enough back in time, everything is causally connected, then at any event in the future, there is information about everything that's going on in the rest of space-time, because far enough in the past, it was all causally connected, and therefore that can influence it. So you could have a conspiracy that didn't require any non-locality, but requires this very careful choreography about what sets of outcomes. So, how do we feel about those kinds of solutions? These, either exploiting these loopholes or exploiting superdeterminisms.
Did,
Did you want to?
We can do super determinism.
Yeah.
We need hidden variables. If we do a quantum unit of hidden variables,
that's true.
It will always be non deterministic. So I guess the problem would these hidden variables, could these hidden variables be still open?
Yeah, the claim of Bell's theorem is, let me be precise about this. We, already way back in 1927, if you believe in the orthodox approach, that quantum state is a complete description of reality, then Einstein's argument, which is in the 1935 EPR paper, but he actually was making it already in 1927, establishes that you have a failure of locality, that what I choose to measure here can influence what the clock state is over there, and if the state over there describes reality, then I have one of two different realities depending on what I've measured. So locality was already out the door if you believed in the orthodox approach. But you might have said, and Einstein thought this, hidden variables can save the day. Because we saw in the last couple lectures that the EPR effect, where you're doing the same kind of measurements on both wings, say Z spin and X spin, that can be easily explained in a local way. You're just updating your information about what's going on over here, but there's no need of any kind of causal influence. So Bell's genius was to show, let's change things, so instead of measuring Z and X here, Z and X there, we're now measuring different bases, and showed that the correlations are now so strong that the way Einstein had tried to explain the EPR effect was no longer available. You can't explain Bell inequality violations as just an updating of your knowledge of what's going on far away. And so, so what Bell's theorem shows is that even if you have hidden variables, you can't explain this locally. It also shows that if you don't have hidden variables, if the quantum state's complete description, you can't explain the correlations locally. But we didn't need Bell's theorem to know that. We already knew that because of EPR. So how do we feel about the superdeterminism loophole, the detector loophole? Are these plausible ways of salvaging locality?
For plausible ways to salvage locality, I would think no, because they're a lot more implausible than destroying locality. On the other hand, things to actually say that, in fact, we don't have locality, you do have to legitimately look at alternate possibilities if you're going to say for certainty that you don't have locality. But if you're just trying to use it to salvage locality, mm-hmm. it seems very suspicious that you're adding in more of a sort of humanistic side of nature in order to have a vast conspiracy in order to make it appear as if this exists when it doesn't. And
so conspiratorial theories are implausible.
Not impossible, but impossible.
Impossible. Okay. Other thoughts?
Especially when talking about something that's not human.
Okay. Sure. You're talking about particles.
Yeah.
At the back.
I think the superdeterminism is probably the one we should pick.
I'm sorry.
We should go for superdeterminism.
You think
is as physicists, so the things we've assumed already lead us to the conclusions that causality and locality are held. I mean, they're basically the same thing anyway, right? From special relativity.
Causality and locality?
Yeah, because if you've got a non-local communication, then you can just, it's equivalent to a Minkowski diagram.
The relativists use the term causality to basically mean that there's no signaling faster than the speed of light.
Yeah. But as physicists, it's violating a law of physics, whereas superdeterminism isn't violating laws of physics, it's like laws of metaphysics, which we don't really know much about. So, as physicists, we should accept superdeterminism, right? Because it doesn't break any rules. But,
okay.
It's
interesting.
Something that helps.
Sure.
Yeah. These loopholes, it's like believing that particles are just believing like assholes and just
behaving like assholes.
And just trying to make us believe that it's no, it doesn't work.
Particles are good guys. How could they do that?
But even if they did, then we can integrate that they're behaving like assholes in our theory, and then, well, we can predict that they should still believe. We'll be like households in the next experiments.
I think Einstein said, God is subtle but not malicious.
Subtle is the Lord, but malicious is not.
Well, we're basically out of time. So let me add one other point to this, and we'll continue with this topic at the beginning of the next lecture, and I'll go into more of the technical details of what Bell's criterion of locality is. So far, we've been using an intuitive notion of locality, but I'll get more technical. But let me just say this about the loopholes, which is you can criticize things for being ad hoc. And when I say ad hoc, I mean something technical, which is that you can introduce a hypothesis, you know, to solve a problem, but if it only solves that one problem, then it's ad hoc, right? So if I say, okay, I have a solution, but there's nothing else that recommends this besides the thing it was introduced to solve, then it's ad hoc. So you could say of these loopholes, you know, imagining a theory wherein particles exploit these loopholes to create an appearance of Bell inequality violations is ad hoc, because this makes no other predictions besides, you know, the one that we require to salvage a locality and generate these experimental statistics. Whereas if, you know, you show that those theories predicted other things that were then corroborated by experiments, then it might have some merit. But a lot of people would say, because it's right now, it just seems completely ad hoc, we don't really need to seal these loopholes to see that there's something interesting going on. So let's end there, and I'll see you tomorrow. Yes?
I was going to say, in response to the whole superdeterminism thing, basically you're saying that,
you're making an assumption that a knowledge about the person.
Yeah, I've written that down, so I don't want to integrate our theory as well.
Quote is it?
Get some
rules.